regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's fourth branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Colton Grob. I'm the deputy director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. If you would like to learn more about each of our speakers and their work, you can visit regproject.org, where we have their full bios. After opening remarks and discussion between our panelists, we will go to audience Q&A, so please be thinking of the questions you'd like to ask our speakers. This afternoon, we're pleased to host the second of a two-part discussion exploring the topic of data portability. We're pleased to welcome Jay Israelis, founder and managing partner of Elevicon LLC, Bruce Hoffman, partner at Cleary, Gottlieb, Stein, and Hamilton, LLP, and Alex Petros, policy counsel at Public Knowledge. Today's conversation will be moderated by Ashley Baker, Director of Public Policy at Committee for Justice. I'll now hand it off to Ashley to kick things off. Ashley?
Thank you for that introduction. So by way of background, just a bit about data portability and interoperability. So many competition agencies today, including those in the U.S., are considering data portability mandates to increase, or supposedly increase, depending on how you look at it, competition. These would require companies to make customers' data available to move to other services or to make their services interoperable with others so that users could share their data between services on an ongoing basis. However, there is evidence that data portability mandates, when used as a competition remedy, is costly, ineffective, and may reduce business incentives and could entrench incumbents by making it difficult for smaller competitors to change their services and modernize their products. This comes as many competition agencies and legislatures alike are considering interoperability and data portability mandates to increase competition. And Congress is set to release a report, and now they have released a report, with recommendations for reducing the market power of online platforms, which may include these mandates. So for those of you who don't know, over the past 2 days, we've had two reports come out from the House Judiciary Committee, one from the majority and one from the minority. There is one specific section entitled Data Portability and Interoperability. So to kind of kick off this conversation, I'd just like the panelists to weigh in on the more open-ended question of, in your view, do data portability and interoperability mandated data sharing have a role to play in remedying these competition issues that were the focus of the just released House Judiciary Committee report on antitrust? And with that, I will hand it over to Bruce.
Sure, thanks. So let me give you a couple of quick thoughts. I would say, as a general proposition, I think data portability, interoperability, or mandatory data sharing, which, you know, those are things that overlap quite a bit, although there are some differences on the margin or can be differences in terms of what they actually are or what they might require in particular circumstances. But I think any of those tools or all of them together can be appropriate tools to remedy anti-competitive conduct or perhaps as remedies in a merger, you know, a transaction of some kind. But I think it's important to bear in mind that when you impose those kinds of requirements, they have significant effects, right? So data portability, well, first of all, interoperability creates a question or raises a lot of questions about what are you doing to competitive incentives, to interactions between competitors? Are you actually just creating a situation where firms are going to piggyback on more innovative or more successful firms, which in turn might suppress the incentives of the innovators to really work as hard as they can to provide the best products or the most innovative products possible. Data portability and mandated data sharing have similar issues, right? So data portability can be a solution if, for example, you have a circumstance where there's arguable customer lock-in. because they've accumulated a lot of data in a particular system or in a particular ecosystem. And so it's very difficult to switch to another ecosystem, which in turn could, at least in theory, create entry barriers. So if you allow data portability, then you could resolve those kinds of concerns. But on the other hand, if you do that, then you're perhaps going to suppress the incentives of firms to collect and do things with that data in the first place. Data sharing may be somewhat broader, where you say not only do people have does the user, the person who's sort of created the data, have the right to move their data with them if they choose to switch, which, you know, obviously has competitive implications, right? That might sharpen competition between platforms. But data sharing is more of a requirement, I think, can be better viewed as imposing a requirement on firms to share data with their potential rivals, even where the customers haven't requested it. And I think, again, you can imagine circumstances where that's an appropriate path, and I'll get to just a couple of those in a second. But the risk there is quite high, that you're essentially imposing on firms a duty to help their rivals, and particularly to help their rivals that are less effective, less innovative, less successful, which I think is highly problematic. And, you know, so I think any of these tools, you've got to be very cautious about how you use them and when you use them. So that said, how and when do you use these? Well, one, I think the best setting in which you employ these kind of tools is where you have demonstrated anti-competitive harm. So you have a case where a firm is engaged in anti-competitive conduct, and that conduct involved data issues or interoperability issues, denial of interoperability, for example, and where you can be reasonably confident that you can craft a remedy using one of these tools that's going to be effective in solving that competitive problem, addressing that anti-competitive conduct, and won't create a high risk of unanticipated negative effects. The second scenario is where you do it kind of writ large, ex ante, perhaps as some sort of regulatory tool. There, I think antitrust doesn't have a lot to say, right? Antitrust is not, for the most part, a system of ex ante regulation or sectoral regulation. Sector regulators do impose these kinds of things. For example, there's interoperability requirements in the phone system. But I think the cautionary note there is a lot of regulated environments that have these kinds of obligations imposed in a broad ex ante kind of way often seem to exhibit less innovation and less competition over time than markets that don't have these kinds of regulatory systems imposed. Now, there's a question about, it's kind of a chicken and egg question, like, do you have a market that doesn't work well and so you impose these kinds of requirements to help improve competition in what otherwise would be an uncompetitive market? Or are you constraining innovation and keeping the market functioning badly by imposing these restrictions? And actually, both of those things can be true. But I think as a sectoral regulator or as an ex ante regulation, this is an area to be very cautious about, though I wouldn't rule it out. It depends on the market. But I'd say I've stunned everyone into silence.
All right, I'm going to go next. Thank you, Ashley, and thanks to the Federal Society for organizing this great and timely panel. But let me first speak about data portability, interoperability, and mandatory data sharing as potential antitrust remedies. Calls for using these regulatory tools as antitrust remedies are premised on this notion that large technology firms are holding large quantities of data and that smaller firms and entrants and need access to that data to compete effectively. I believe this notion is misguided. Data are non-rivalrous. This means that the use of data by one firm does not preclude another firm from using the same data. If a user gives his data to a service provider, he can just as easily give the same data to another provider. Access to incumbents' data is not necessary for successful entry. Data can be an important asset, but advocates of regulations overstate the role of data as an obstacle to entry. Entrants can acquire data by acquiring customers, investing in research, or licensing data from data vendors. This is the same way that incumbents acquire their data when they enter their market. There are countless examples of successful entry by online service providers without entrants obtaining access to incumbents' data. Take, for example, Instagram, Tinder, or most recently, TikTok. I should also say that from my perspective, it's not clear that the antitrust issues discussed in the House report are actually antitrust harms. But this is a conversation for another day. But if the targets of the House report actually engaged in anti-competitive behavior by acquiring market power through anti-competitive acquisitions or anti-competitive conduct, there are remedies that are much more direct and effective than data portability, interoperability, or data share. Antitrust enforcers could seek to unwind anti-competitive mergers, break up big tech companies, stop anti-competitive conduct directly, and seek monetary relief. So let me now speak about the potential economic effects of portability, interoperability, and data sharing. Data portability allows users to move their personal data between platforms or vendors. This is a benefit for users. Online platforms offer data portability as a feature to their users. For example, the Data Transfer Project is an initiative by Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Apple, and Twitter to create a service-to-service data portability platform allowing individuals to move their data between online service providers. Data portability implicates privacy issues and their significant implementation challenges. However, data portability may enhance competition in some cases by making it easier for consumers to switch online providers and avoid lock-in. That said, data portability also has some potentially negative effects. Data portability may encourage free riding, which may be bad for innovation. This is especially the case under the proposals that would require incumbents to port not just the data provided by the users, but also the data that the incumbents developed about the users and their usage patterns. And so let me now speak about interoperability. Interoperability brings a different set of policy challenges. Interoperability is the ability of different systems to work together or to communicate with each other. Interoperability often uses open standards that allow systems to exchange data. For example, the Hypertext Transfer Protocol is the basis of all communication on the internet. That's an open interoperability standard. Interoperability is often a really good thing. Because of interoperability, iPhones can communicate with Android phones. This is an important consumer benefit. However, there are also important benefits of having closed systems. Closed and open systems can coexist and compete. For example, the iOS system is relatively closed, whereas the Android system is open. The advantage of a closed system is that it gives its operator more control over its functionality and gives it more flexibility to make changes to the system. A closed system such as iOS may have stronger privacy and cybersecurity protections than an open system based on an Android operating system. An interoperability standard may also force participants into having some common functionality. Whether the benefits of interoperability outweighs disadvantages is a question for the marketplace. Should the government force private companies to adopt open interoperability standards for the sake of enhancing competition? I think it's a bad idea, especially in markets undergoing changes and innovation and where users use multiple platforms. Closed systems can and do compete with each other. And it's not at all clear that interoperability would enhance competition or would make entry any easier. Imposing interoperability may also inhibit Trumpeterian competition that provides significant innovation. For example, if regulators require interoperability in social media platforms, we may all still be using MySpace and be stuck with all of its features or lack of features. Well, on the other hand, we would still have MySpace Tom as a friend. Last thing, on data sharing proposals that would force companies to share their internal data with competitors, I think that is a very bad idea. Data sharing proposals would diminish incentives to innovate. The incumbent would have weaker incentives to acquire new data if it had to share its data with a competitor. The entrant would also have weaker incentives to acquire new data if you could just free ride and get the data from an incumbent. The data sharing proposals would also create unhealthy entanglements between competitors that may facilitate coordination and harm competition. In addition, data sharing proposals may undermine formation of new markets for data transfer, data licensing, where incumbents, having generated a lot of data, could license their data to other users, or third parties could aggregate data from different sources and merge different data sets, merge the data into new data sets and license those out. So I think I'll stop here.
Okay, and with that, Alex, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Ashley. So at the outset, I want to say how incredibly honored I am to be speaking alongside Bruce and Jay today. You know, they've both had amazing careers and incredibly humbling to be speaking on the same panel as them. So I am here to defend data portability and interoperability. To me, these are objectively good things, not just for competition writ large, but consumers too. If you were to quiz consumers and their thoughts on data portability and interoperability, their feelings to me would be almost universally positive. Well, maybe first they'd ask what those things mean. There's a tendency to talk about these things in a pie-in-the-sky fashion with abstract theories, but really at its heart, data portability and interoperability are about freedom. It's about freedom to own your own data, freedom to take your data to the companies you want. It's important to note that we have interoperability in current regimes, and it works great. Think about how you can call someone on any telephone network, email someone on any email service. Even on this call, I bet the four of us called in from different networks. You don't need to worry what network the person you're calling is on. But just imagine the headache if this wasn't the case. The outrage if tomorrow AT&T was like, sorry, you can only call AT&T customers now. No more Verizon or T-Mobile. That's exactly what a lot of digital markets are like today, though. Perhaps the two biggest weapons in a competitive arsenal of a company like Facebook are its network effects and its use of data. Data portability and interoperability helps to weaken both. So first up, network effects. What's this? I like to think of the little mermaid who, you know, said she wanted to be where the people are. Think about how as more people join Facebook, it gets more competitively powerful. Users gain from other users being on the social network. Your aunt joining Facebook is good for you, and that you can follow your aunt now. Well, you know, maybe it's not great if you're not a fan of your aunt. But it's also good for all the other people who can now connect to your aunt in turn. Don't take my word for it. According to the Blockbuster House Judiciary Report, I'm sure we will, you know, find some ways to work in on this call. You know, Mark Zuckerberg sees his market in the same way. Documents from his acquisition of Instagram are all about strengthening Facebook's network effects. Second, data. To me, data is the currency and the lifeblood of these online platforms. The reason that so many of them are free up front are because they collect massive amounts of data on you. And that data can then in turn become targeted ads. Data portability means they have to give you your data when you ask for it. We know exactly what data a company like Facebook has on us. Maybe they would think twice before exploiting our privacy. Now, imagine if a platform like Facebook had true data portability and interoperability, something beyond their weak and relatively hidden download your information tool. You know exactly what data Facebook has on you. And imagine if you could take your hard-won friends list with you. So I'm 26, so I grew up on Facebook. My many friends span different times in my life, you know, middle school to high school, various summer camps, college, summer jobs. Many of the camps I attended growing up, we didn't have access to phones or computers during the actual camp. So after the camp, it was almost a ritual of adding all your newfound friends on Facebook when you got home. I have friends from all over the state of Kentucky, where I'm from, the country, the world even. And not losing that is what keeps me on Facebook. You're not going to leave Facebook if it means losing those connections. But imagine if you could connect with your Facebook friends on a different platform. You'd be far more likely to change platforms. Now, interoperability and data portability, you know, data sharing mandates, you know, they won't magically solve all the competition problems in digital platform markets. It's not a silver bullet. It's, you know, in there's a reason why it's just one of many potential reforms offered up by something like that House Judiciary Report. But it is needed to allow true competition to grow. And the good news is there's bipartisan support for these things. If you look at the Ken Buck report, he talks up interoperability, data portability as, hey, this is something I think Republicans can get on board with. And you know, I agree with some of what Jay and Bruce have said, and that data interoperability, data portability and interoperability are not perfect by any means. But I think it is a step in the right direction. It's something that's feasible and, most importantly, could be pretty quick, something that could happen tomorrow. So I say, let's do it. That's all for me. Ashley, back to you.
Thank you, Jay. So with that, let's go ahead and just jump right into the House Judiciary Committee report and the minority report, because I know that's what's on top of everyone's minds right now. So can you guys all take a bit of time just to weigh in on what's in those reports, what's not in those reports, what should be in the reports, you know, the pros and cons of each of those?
Sure. So this is Bruce. Maybe I'll take a stab first, some discussion about the reports generally. Let me just, by way of disclaimer, say I'm still sort of wading through them all. These are, how should I put this? They're not short, but there's a lot there. But I think a couple of things about the reports. One is, I don't think that the reports, and I think this is true for both, really. I don't think they do a great job of identifying antitrust enforcement problems, as opposed to what they, I think, more generally describe as, or think, seem to think about as what they perceive or the authors perceive as market problems. And I think a lot of that kind of bears on this point, when you think about data portability, mandatory data sharing or interoperability, and you think of this as remedies, it's kind of important to really understand what problem is it you're trying to fix. Right. So if you say, well, I've got a market that has a relatively small number of players, let's talk about, say, for example, social networking, right? Let's assume that's a market. I'm not, you know, there's what a market is in antitrust is actually a really complicated question that isn't something that you just resolve by saying, well, you know, social networking looks like a thing, so we'll call that a market. But for ease of discussion, why don't we just take that as a market? So you could say, yeah, so right now it appears that in social networking, you've got a player, Facebook, that's very strong with a very high share and, you know, including all of its various subsidiaries. And you don't see a whole lot of challengers out there. So one of the problems, I think, in the report is it tends to jump from that to the conclusion that this is because of some kind of failure of competition law, which may or may not be the case, right? It's certainly the case that, or it certainly isn't the case that competition law enforcement is perfect. You know, Facebook did a number of acquisitions under the Obama administration that people like to look back at afterwards and say, well, with the benefit of hindsight, we think those were bad. So maybe those were mistaken, maybe they weren't. You know, maybe those deals should have been blocked, maybe not. But as a general proposition, the fact that you have a firm which has a really large share and is maintaining that share for a period of time could be the result of a failure of competition law, could be a result of the failure of antitrust enforcement or of some failure of the overall regulatory environment. But it also could be the result of that firm just being a better and more effective competitor, right? So when you consider, you know, Facebook or you consider Google or any other firm that, you know, Apple, any of these firms that are frequently singled out and that are singled out in the report, a lot of what's missing is an analysis of whether what they have, whether anything they've done or whether much of what they've done has been anti-competitive in the sense that it restricts the opportunities of their rivals to compete by some means other than competing with them on the merits, other than being a better competitor. So that, I think that's a huge omission. And by the way, the report is not unique in this. You know, I spoke at a conference in Europe in early winter of 2018, where basically a whole slew of panelists or speakers got up and said, well, you know, we have these digital firms that are really large, and so what do we do about it? And I kind of raised my hand. I said, well, wait a minute. The fact that they're large is equally consistent with them being better competitors as it is with them having behaved anti-competitively. So why do you think you have to do anything about it? The second thing that's missing in the report, or really understated in the report, is the question of whether we're making what I would call an efficiencies offense kind of argument. So one of the things the report tends to highlight is data makes your product better, right? So information makes what you do better. And it's easy. And, you know, this is a point I think that's pretty obvious, right? When you, and Alex got made this point as well, when you have more data about somebody, you can offer them a better product because you know more about what they want. Easiest example to conceptualize this is mapping software or mapping apps. So if I have a mapping app on my phone, it's going to be a hell of a lot more useful if it knows, for example, where I am. If it doesn't know where I am, it's not going to be that useful for me. It'll be somewhat useful, just like an old paper map was, but that's it. But by knowing where I am, it provides much better info. Then if it takes that information about where I am and how fast I'm moving and puts that information together with similar information about lots of other people, the value of that product to me becomes exponentially better, right? And so because that way the app can tell me, hey, there's traffic, or, you know, people are moving slowly here, they're moving quickly here. There's lots of other information it can give me that's incredibly useful. And there's a tendency in the report to confuse providing additional benefit to users with something that's anti-competitive. And that's a really dangerous trap to fall into. None of this is to say, you know, I think Alex made good points that, you know, and I made, I think, kind of similar points at the beginning, that the report indicates that whether you view this as an ex-ante regulatory solution or as some kind of competition law solution, you can restructure the way markets work by imposing data portability requirements that allows people to move back and forth. It might sharpen competition between ecosystems that otherwise might be difficult to achieve. You can impose interoperability requirements by some form of ex-ante regulation. So you can say, you know, for example, with telephone systems that they have to interoperate, and that makes them much more useful. Those things are all true, but I don't think that they're unmitigated goods, and I don't think the report does a great job of sorting out what is beneficial and what is not, and what are the real causes of the issues that we're seeing.
Yeah, this is Alex. So if, you know, I agree with some of that, but I, you know, obviously want to push back on some of that as well. So personally, I was a huge fan of the report. It's something, you know, we at Public Knowledge have been anxiously awaiting for very, very long time. And, you know, I think it's going to be an incredible resource moving forward for whether it be policymakers, Congress's next steps, but also advocates like me. So I would push back on, you know, the report just saying, okay, you know, a company like, say, Facebook, you know, has monopoly power in social networking. And I think there's a little bit more there than it's just that they're big. You know, the report details email exchanges, documents, all on, you know, whether it be Instagram, WhatsApp, about how they very much saw these as a way to neutralize a potential competitor. One of my favorite parts of the report, there's like an email exchange where like Zuckerberg just like comes right out and you know, says that, oh, we're, you know, buying Instagram to neutralize a potential competitor. But then, like, an hour or so later, he sends, like, a follow-up email being like, oh, I didn't, like, you know, really mean to say that. He'd obviously consulted with somebody and, you know, realized he, you know, had made a mistake there. And then I think kind of with, you know, data portability and interoperability, I think it's important to note that some of the potential anti-competitive conduct that Facebook has engaged in, like, has to do with the strategic use of interoperability. So ways in which if you are a complement to the Facebook platform, so think of, you know, Farmville back in the day, or kind of the, you know, games that your grandmother was, like, really into, Facebook kind of welcomed you into the ecosystem, because at the end of the day, they could, you know, use your vector as a way to, you know, keep people on Facebook services, can continue growing Facebook, continue collecting that data. But then as soon as they saw you as a threat, they would cut off access to Facebook. And that's something that, you know, as an upstart, you know, company, social network, you know, kind of a death knell for you. So the big example here is Vine, which, you know, was a Twitter product that, you know, really took off a couple years ago, and in many ways is similar to TikTok, but was cut off, you know, personally by Mark Zuckerberg, and then proceeded to wither out and die. I mean, you know, maybe that story is more complicated. You know, it again can be hard to say, well, you know, if this didn't happen, then, you know, Vine would have flourished, but it certainly contributed. And I think, you know, when you look at, like, I think it's an important question to ask of, like, you know, why isn't TikTok an American company? Like, and, you know, the complete lack of innovation that we've had in, you know, the social networking market, or, you know, search, or, you know, these, like, markets where we kind of have a dominant player. And, you know, would consumers be better served by having more competition? I would say yes.
Jay, do you have anything to add to that? Okay, it's not
Ashley. Jay may be on mute, but this is Bruce. Let me just make three very quick points. By the way, I think the points Alex made are all valid points. I don't disagree with any of them, but I would say it's, again, the story is a little more complicated, right? So number one, the fact that Mark Zuckerberg thought that the Instagram acquisition was done for the purpose of eliminating a competitor or a potential competitor, a nascent threat, is an important fact, right? So it's worthwhile taking people seriously, right? Especially when they're the CEO of a company and, you know, they're saying what they think is the truth. But Facebook Instagram has been studied repeatedly in the academic literature, and there is no robust conclusion that merger was actually anti-competitive. Because the critical thing that you have to bear in mind is it's not clear what Instagram would have done had it not been acquired, right? You're talking about 10 or 12 people who have no real revenue, and it's possible that Instagram would have flourished and grown into a major competitor to Facebook, or it's possible that it would have disappeared and amounted to nothing. Who knows? Offsetting that, though, it's not the case that Facebook bought Instagram and buried the technology and did nothing with it. Instead, it improved it and rolled it out across the Facebook platform. So So it gave millions of people much faster access to the Instagram system than would ever have been the case had Instagram been a standalone company, which is a substantial pro-competitive benefit. Now, how do you net those two things out to determine which is better? That's a complicated question. I'm just saying it's not the mere fact that Zuckerberg says X does not necessarily make it so. And in fact, when you look at that specific transaction, the actual competitive effect is highly ambiguous. Second, the point that Alex made about firms suddenly deciding that, you know, when what previously was a compliment becomes a competitor, then the firm that previously was dealing with it changes its course of dealing. That's not surprising at all, right? When you're a firm and you're dealing with a compliment, so suppose I'm a supermarket and or I'm a shopping mall or whatever, and there's somebody who wants to sell something in my market or sell it in my mall, and I like doing that and I work with them because it's a compliment. It drives more traffic to my market or my mall, so everybody's better off. Now they decide they're going to go and open a competing store next door, and I treat them differently. Well, of course. I mean, this is not unique to digital. This is a ubiquitous feature of human economies through all of recorded history. We treat competitors differently than we treat compliments, and there are good reasons for that. And forced duties to share with your competitors, forced duties to help your competitors, sometimes are necessary, and it's clear in some, particularly in industries that have natural monopoly issues or where you have to regulate, they can be very valuable. But there are serious negative consequences to forced duties to share with competitors that are not present when you're dealing with compliments. You know, the last point in terms of Vine and what happens when Facebook acquires a firm and what do we judge about, you know, why did TikTok evolve versus others? Well, again, all of this could be true, right? But it's not clear, it's not necessarily the case that simply because, for example, Facebook, by treating Vine differently, harmed its ability to compete, that is ultimately bad for competition. Competition doesn't necessarily require competitors to give each other helping hands. And in fact, when they do, that can lead to collusion. It's not the case that there's been no competition in social networking or search. There's been a lot. It's just nobody has been able to win. You know, Google tried to compete with Facebook in social networking and failed. Does that mean that something anti-competitive was going on or that there's some natural monopoly that needs to be addressed by regulation? Maybe. It's certainly possible. But could it also simply mean that Facebook just did a better job than Google? Also possible. And you've got to be very careful not to destroy the incentive to do a better job in the name of remedying a problem that may or may not exist or may or may not exist at the level we think it does.
Yes. So Bruce, you're right. I was on mute. I hope you can hear me now. So first, I want to say a few things about House Report and also respond to some of the things that Alex said in his opening statement. First, I agree with Bruce about the dangers of forcing firms to engage with competitors and duty to deal that has lots of negative implications. On Facebook, Instagram, I think that lots of people have looked at the effects, and there is no evidence of any anti-competitive effect of the transaction. In fact, the CMA has done a retrospective look at the transaction. Granted, it's very difficult to analyze the effect of the transaction because you don't know what would have happened but for the transaction. But CMA commissioned a study that found no evidence of anti-competitive effects. In fact, when Facebook bought Instagram, it had 30 million users. It has over a billion users now. It had tremendous growth. So it's very hard to make a case that the acquisition itself was anti-competitive. On the House report, I think there are several issues, several problems. The issues they focused on in the report, not clear to me they're actually antitrust harms. They focus on the big tech companies being very large. They focus on exploitive abuse, but that's under our system. That's not a harm. If you are big, if you're successful, you can being a monopolist is not illegal. You can charge whatever you want, and within reason, set conditions for dealing with other firms. The other problem with the report is that it's a little unclear what is the goal of antitrust in their vision of antitrust. Is it something that protects consumers, looks to maximize consumer well-being surplus, or is it something where being big is bad? And the two notions are different and not consistent. We have a system where, free market system, where if you're successful and you gain a lot of business, gain a lot of customers, you make a lot of money, you're rewarded for providing a lot of benefit and innovation. And the report acknowledges that these companies that are the focus of their investigation have generated a tremendous amount of consumer benefit. I think it's obvious to everybody. So is it a problem that they invested in something, became very successful, and it grew the business? Amazon, Google are tremendous success stories. And now the companies are very large. Is that something that they should be punished for? So the other issue with the House report is that it's unclear what the remedy is. I mean, the remedies that they propose, the recommendations, are sort of vague. But more importantly, it's not clear what they would do to solve the problem, or whatever the problem is. I guess the issue is they don't tell you exactly what the problem is. Is it that the companies are too big, or is it that consumers are being harmed? And preventing large tech from acquiring new firms in order to grow and be efficient could have very bad negative consequences for innovation. And this is an important exit strategy for startups and venture capital that's been really driving innovation, and cutting that off could have, you know, very bad, severe consequences for innovation. So I wanted to say a couple of things about what Alex said in his opening statement. So I agree with the first part of Alex's statement. I think that data portability and interoperability could be really good things. And they may be reason to have more of it. But I just don't think those are necessarily good antitrust remedies. You know, as an antitrust remedy, there could be more harm than good, especially on interoperability. Forcing social media platforms to work together and talk to each other, I think there is more potential for anti-competitive effect than remedying of competition. And I also don't agree that there has not been a lot of innovation in social and media platforms. There are just it's just hard for smaller social media platforms to grow, but there's lots and lots of niche social media platforms, and they're successful. And users have lots of options. Yes, there are network effects, and this is something that makes a lot of people use Facebook, because Facebook has a lot of users, and you want to be on a platform that has a lot of users that you can connect to. But that's actually a consumer benefit. The network effects create consumer benefits. The reason why people want to use Facebook and be on Facebook is because there is a benefit to having lots and lots of users on the same network. And the last thing about data, I don't see data as a competition problem. I see it as something that enhances competition, makes products better, and makes firms compete more intensively. So I don't think we need to prevent firms from looking to acquire more data. they should be encouraged to gather more data in a way that respects users' privacy. But it is a very important source of innovation, and is driving innovation in artificial intelligence. And perhaps we need to find a way to share this data more widely, because that will improve innovation. But we should definitely not stop companies from looking to acquire more data. So I'll stop right there.
So before we go in, before I allow each of you a minute or two to kind of wrap up your arguments and then we go into Q&A, one last final question is, we've been focused on data portability and interoperability as if it's kind of, I wouldn't say a cure-all, but kind of the only remedy that's really set forth in the report without going too much into the other proposals out there. But how do data portability mandates compare to other competition-enhancing mandates or remedies that might be under consideration right now by the FTC or the DOJ or Congress?
Yeah, this is Alex. Happy to start off with this. So one of the things I really liked about the report is that it really does not take an either-or sort of view of things. Like, these markets are incredibly complex. I think there, you know, are, you know, competition issues, you know, rife in them. And, you know, thus, like, I think the report recognized that, like, we need to do many different things. Sorry, that's my new puppy in the background.
Okay. Well, hello to the puppy.
I know. He's very excited that somebody is dropping off our mail. But so what the report does is there's kind of three buckets. Like, the first bucket is making sure our antitrust laws as currently written are strongly enforced against these online platforms. And, you know, I think, you know, there you look at, you know, calling for more resources and, you know, staff, so that dedicated professionals at the FTC and DOJ can, you know, really go after these tech platforms and, you know, not be completely outgunned. Like, this is big tobacco 2.0. And then there's also, you know, changes to the antitrust laws to kind of level the playing field, whether you look at, you know, various, you know, Supreme Court precedents that, in, you know, my view are, you know, misguided, whether it be, you know, precedents that basically make predatory pricing claims just dead in the water, refusal to deal claims in the dead in the water, looking at kind of burdens, presumptions, and, you know, ways in which, you know, I think there's a reason that the, you know, FTC and DOJ didn't, you know, bring more cases, you know, on the rise of Facebook, on the rise of Google, Amazon, Apple to a lesser extent, I would say. And that's that our laws as currently written, you know, have done a poor job of getting at the unique nature of these digital platforms. And then the third bucket, which is what data portability and interoperability kind of fall into, are regulatory remedies beyond antitrust law. And so there, they look at that. They, you know, I think also in there's a self-preferencing rule. You know, public knowledge is, you know, called for a new digital regulatory agency, which we think would be, you know, best handled to go after many of these regulations. But, you know, these powers could also be given to the FTC or DOJ. And really, by, like, doing all three at once, you know, have the ability to really kind of rein in these platforms in a way that, you know, just doing one of them does not. You know, there are many, many people on my side of the aisle who are constantly like, okay, we need to break up big tech. That's the only way forward. You know, Facebook must spin off Instagram, must spin off WhatsApp. Google, you have to separate your search and your online advertising advertising business. And like, while that may be needed, like, I think it's important to note that, you know, we've done breakups in the past, and like, it takes a really, really long time of, you know, filing a case, and then, you know, I almost guarantee you there's going to be appeals. There's going to be, so we're talking years, maybe even a decade to which, you know, we'll see actual results there. But a lot of the regulatory remedies, stuff like I mentioned earlier, you know, data portability, interoperability, there are bills introduced now that have bipartisan support. You can look at the Access Act in the Senate, you know, which, you know, has a Josh Hawley along with a, you know, Dick Blumenthal, two people who, you know, don't agree on a ton, but yet, you know, are coming together on this is, you know, something that, again, like, won't solve everything. And like, I don't think it's just overnight going to, you know, Facebook's going to see they have a million and one new competitors, but I think it'll have, you know, some effect. And I also think there's really something to be said for making, making Facebook face some competitive pressure in a way that I don't think that they face now. There's really, I think, a lot of consumer benefit to be gained from Facebook being worried about upstart competitors, whether that means strengthening their privacy policies, you know, innovating and adding new features. I think that could be a real consumer good.
I'll start with that last point, which I completely agree with, right? The more competitive pressure you face, the more likely you are to compete well, in other words, to innovate, to provide better service, to provide lower price, or, you know, any of the metrics on which you choose to measure competition. Ashley, to go back to your question, look, the FTC and the DOJ they're not industrial planners, right? So they don't set up markets to be the way they want. They bring cases. The FTC has a significant research and development aspect, so it does reports, it does analyses. So that's a thought leadership piece that the FTC kind of leads in for the federal government. DOJ contributes to that. The DOJ is more of a law enforcer, you know, qua law enforcer. FTC has this kind of dual mission. But in terms of law enforcement, in terms of remedies, both the FTC and the DOJ remedy specific anti-competitive conduct. So if you look at, you know, Facebook or anybody like that, if you say, okay, well, did Facebook engage in some specific act of anti-competitive conduct or in a specific merger or a set of mergers which were anti-competitive? And if so, then you're the FTC. You try to remedy that by whatever means are appropriate, including relief that may go beyond narrowly addressing the problem that you found, because there's a well-known concept called fencing in, where you take other steps to ensure your remedy works. So I think a lot of what's in the House report goes well beyond that. As Alex pointed out, you know, a lot of what's in the House report is more industrial engineering, industrial planning. It's regulatory. It's how should the markets be set up, as opposed to have the market participants behaved anti-competitively, and if so, what do we do about it? So I think the overlap between law enforcement and industrial planning, you know, there's slight overlap, but they're really kind of different things. And the House report kind of takes on both, whereas the FTC or the DOJ would only take on anti-competitive conduct and not industrial planning. All those things said, I think there's the concern that I have here is we're right at the step of remedy without clear evidence that we're remedying anything that's actually bad. I think there's a real danger here that's problem one. And then problem two is there's a serious danger in doing things to fix a perceived problem that have ramifications that go well beyond anything that we can currently anticipate. Jay highlighted a few of those. I won't say much about them other than to highlight one particular point, which is self-preferencing. So it's easy to make self-preferencing sound bad, right? How can you be, in the words of Senator Warren, you know, how can you be the umpire and play the game, right? It's a great soundbite. It's total gibberish from an economic standpoint. The economics of self-preferencing are very ambiguous, and the canonical example, the basic point in self-preferencing, is that it's usually pro-competitive. And think about why that might be so. And I'll just give an example I've given in some other talks. A shopping mall is a platform. A shopping mall has stores in it. The shopping mall doesn't care what those stores are selling. It just wants more people to come to the mall and go to more stores and buy more stuff at those stores so it can get more rent. It's totally indifferent as to what the mix of store is, except insofar as that mix of stores makes the customer experience better and so causes more people to come to the mall. So why would a shopping mall vertically integrate and self-preference? So why would a shopping mall, for example, open its own burger joint or shoe store? Is it to gain extra profit? No, because all it needs to do to get extra profit is just raise the rent. It doesn't need to go to all the trouble to learn how to make burgers and sell shoes and then get space and open it up and hire people and do all that stuff that you need to do. It can just raise the rent. So there's no obvious anti-competitive motive. The most likely reason why a shopping mall would decide to vertically integrate and provide a service itself and even to put itself in the most prominent place, for example, is not because it's trying to make more money. It's because the shopping mall has concluded that something in the current offering is deficient and customers don't like it. And customers are not coming to the mall, or they're not coming and staying as long as they otherwise would, or they're not spending as much as they otherwise would because the burger joints there are bad or the shoe stores are bad. And so the shopping mall decides, well, I can fix that. I'm going to make better burgers or I'm going to sell better shoes, and that will get more people in my mall and they'll spend longer and they'll spend more money and everyone will be better off. It's an unambiguous consumer benefit. Now, there are well-recognized theories of anti-competitive harm self-preferencing, but they require very specific facts to exist. And it's too easy, and the House report falls into this trap repeatedly, to simply conflate the idea of self-preferencing with behaving anti-competitively. They are not the same thing. So it's perfectly legitimate for the House to recommend industrial planning, to recommend regulatory solutions, and those solutions may in some cases be good, right? But I think it's too easy to leap to the conclusion that big is bad and we must then hobble the giants. That's a dangerous path to go down.
So let me chime in here for a few minutes. So let me first say some good things about the House report. I think it's highlights some important issues and raises questions and suggests that maybe we don't fully understand the economic effects of some of these markets, and maybe our antitrust enforcement has gotten it wrong. And you know, those are perfectly legitimate questions to examine and consider. And giving enforcers more resources is a good thing. It gives enforcers more capability to go after the right cases. Where I think, and also some of the regulatory suggestions like data portability may indeed be a good thing for consumers and other recommendations as well. Where I think the main issue lies with the recommendations is that it's not clear to me that they are going to do more good than harm. In fact, they may do more harm than good. There are unintended consequences. And something that looks like it may be a harm may, in fact, be a benefit. And Bruce alluded to in his example with self-preferencing. Alex mentioned that antitrust cases are very hard to win, and there is a reason for that. The reason is that you have to show harm to competition, you have to show antitrust harm, and it's very hard to show in many cases because there are both benefits and there are harms, and sometimes benefits outweigh the harms of any specific conduct, like self-preferencing. What the House report seems to be doing is short-circuiting the answer. They want to overturn certain Supreme Court decisions without really showing that they got things wrong. You know, they highlight certain issues, but they do not do a good job of demonstrating that antitrust laws have gotten things wrong. So I'll stop right there.
So we only have a couple of minutes, not really even that, before we get the Q&A. Could you each, in under 2 minutes each, maybe chime in with any concluding thoughts?
Pick one of us to go first.
Jay, you go first then.
Sure. Okay. So the issues about data portability, data sharing, mandatory data sharing, interoperability, implicate some very, very important issues that are at the heart of our information and digital economy. What I want to stress is that we shouldn't come to solutions without really thinking through all the consequences, because there's a potential for a lot of harm. Data is a source for tremendous innovation now and much more innovation to come. So whatever we do, we need to tread very carefully, because we could harm innovation, and that could, you know, erase tremendous value in our growth and our welfare. It's fine to think about data portability, data interoperability and sharing as some sort of regulatory solutions, and we could sort of debate the pros and cons. I think we need to really think twice before using those as remedies for antitrust, because there are lots and lots of problems and reasons not to use these tools as solutions for antitrust.
Hey, Bruce?
Yeah, this is, oh, sorry, Bruce.
Yeah, I think, Alex, I think you should get the last word, so I'll be really brief. I think basically I would say the same things Jay said. I think, as I said at the outset, I think both antitrust remedies for actual anti-competitive conduct for anti-competitive mergers could include any of these kinds of data issues that we've been talking about. I think those are perfectly legitimate where the conduct calls for that as a remedy. And I think as a regulatory matter, governments can and do, and sometimes with great success and sometimes with serious negative unforeseen consequences, impose these kinds of requirements. So I don't have a strong ex-ante view as to whether imposing these kinds of requirements is always going to be good or always going to be bad or should or shouldn't be done. But I do think Jay's point that it's not clear to me that the case has been made that there are systemic problems either in the markets or in competition enforcement that call for these kinds of remedies. So I think caution is called for here. I think the agencies, the antitrust agencies and private enforcers have been working hard on antitrust cases. I think it might be worthwhile to see how those turn out before jumping to conclusions. But, you know, these are all issues that are quite complex and are certainly worthy of continued study.
Hey, and Alex.
Sure. So, you know, I came in defending data portability, interoperability, and I will leave continuing to defend data portability and interoperability. I think when you look at, you know, digital platform markets, whether it be, you know, the companies we all know and maybe don't love that much, Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, you know, doing nothing is not an option here. That, you know, these companies have become dominant, and like we need to do something about it. And I would argue, you know, we should do something as soon as, and in looking for that, like, I think it's important to, and, you know, it can sometimes be lost quite frankly, on, you know, people with on my side of the aisle of, like, what's a feasible remedy? What's something that, you know, could actually, you know, be somewhat accepted by the companies? What's something that, you know, you could get buy-in from both Democrats and Republicans for? And to me, data portability and interoperability is kind of a great low, you know, I wouldn't call it a low-hanging fruit, but like a medium-hanging fruit, maybe, of, you know, something to strive for and work for. And I think at the end of the day, what's so great about it is, like, we, you know, had historical evidence of it, you know, of markets in which this has worked. So, you know, I don't see a reason why it shouldn't work here. And kind of it will align incentives for dominant players to face a competitive pressure that right now I don't think that they feel at all. And that if the, you know, upstart rival coming in, it knows it has interoperability with the dominant player in its pocket, I think, you know, we are giving that upstart rival a fighting chance. And I think that's, you know, maybe good for the upstart rival, but good for competition generally and good for consumers as a whole.
Okay, so now we have just a couple of quick minutes left for the Q&A section. If the folks over at FedStock could take the wheels here.
We'll go to the first question now. Hi, it's Ashley Gum from AT&T, and I appreciate everyone's thoughts today. This has been fantastic. My question's about really the data transfer project. I think its very existence and robustness puts lie to most or all the arguments against using imposed data portability as a competitive solution. Most arguments like fear of collusion seem to fall away as pretextual in my mind. The one that doesn't completely fall away, I suppose, going back to I think Bruce's comments, is the argument that it might reduce innovation. Though I think at this point, we're not talking about exit strategies when we're talking about the members, at least the founding members of the DTP. And I don't know offhand why, for instance, Facebook would have to buy Instagram technology to improve upon it. So I guess I'm just wondering, does the panel have a reaction? Is there a surviving argument that I'm missing? Or, you know, why truly can't we use it as an antitrust remedy if it's already being used and improved upon itself as a consumer protection tool?
So, Ashley, do you want to decide who answers, or how should we proceed here?
Bruce, you seem eager to answer. Why don't you go ahead and take this?
Well, that wasn't the case, but I suppose I made the mistake of stepping forward. But hi, Ashley. So I guess I would say a couple things. I'm paying for my big mouth. Couple things. One, I think there's a significant difference between a voluntary open source initiative that companies decided to enter into to figure out ways to enhance data portability among themselves and with others, you know, as open source, and imposed data portability remedies. You know, I don't think you can necessarily equate the effects of those things, right? Companies do a lot of things voluntarily where if you try to impose something that has the same words in the title but might be very different in practice, either as a remedy in a particular case or as a broader statutory or regulatory remedy, might have very different effects. You know, so for example, if you went to supermarkets and said, well, you have to share all your customer information, all of your loyalty card information, you know, Publix, you've got to share it with Kroger, you know, they might just stop collecting it. You know, I don't know, who knows, but it's, I don't think they're necessarily the same. In terms of innovation, you know, again, let me be clear. I would not take the position that data portability requirements are ipso facto problematic, that you can't ever have them. As I said, I think they can be viable, they can work. Of the various things that we talked about, I think they seem to me to be the least likely to create negative consequences. I just don't think I would say that they're definitely always going to be good. And then insofar as thinking about, say, Facebook, Instagram, the question you asked, I think, was why would Facebook need to buy Instagram? Well, the short answer to that is economic integration creates drastically different incentives and capabilities. How would Facebook have improved Instagram's offering, its systems, et cetera, without acquiring it? Or why couldn't it have done that without acquiring it? Well, the short answer is, I don't know, right? I mean, Instagram may have had a whole series of tools or attributes or, frankly, just engineering capability in its employees that Facebook could not have replicated from the outside or might not have had the economic incentive to replicate. So, you know, firms acquire for lots of reasons. A big reason why you do acquisitions, though, is to eliminate transactions costs. that make otherwise cooperating impossible or replicating impossible. So, you know, some acquisitions are anti-competitive, and maybe that one was. I don't know. But it's not necessarily the case that you can simply replicate without an acquisition the benefits that you would get from an acquisition.
So I would just briefly add that the data transfer project is a pretty good initiative. Some people have suggested that the reason why these firms have initiated this project is, fear of regulations that would actually, have a worse solution. And this is an open source initiative, and not everybody may join. So data portability would work under the data transfer project to the extent that firms would be willing to join the project.
Yeah, and then just to quickly chime in, I think an important point kind of with interoperability, data portability is, like, you can think of it as like aligning in incentives, in that, I don't think that, Mark Zuckerberg or, Sundar Pichai, sit around and, plotting, evil things all day. But, at the same time, they have duties to their shareholders to maximize value. And a lot of what regulations and, a lot of, what the work we try to do is okay, let's align in incentives in a way that, let's align incentives in a way where, Facebook is acting in the best interest of consumers. And, that's not something that I think without, some sort of regulatory framework like interoperability, data sharing, that, like, you can't just expect a company to do this out of the kindness of its heart. Like, you have to make them do it.
Do we have any more questions? I think we're hitting up close against the 2:15, and some of us have some other presentations to get on right now. It's a busy time for antitrust.
We don't. I would like to thank you, Ashley, Bruce, Alex, and Jay. We are very grateful to you for your time and to our live audience for joining us. We welcome listener feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you for joining us. This concludes today's call.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. Catch every new episode when it's released. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.